Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. Podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. And we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to poet Carl Gartung, who is going to be doing a reading here in New Mexico today. I'm delighted now to welcome Jack Leffler. He is an ethnomusicologist and oral historian. He's the author of the book La Música de los Viejitos, Hispano Folk Music of the Rio Grande del Norte. And Paul Ingalls joins us. He is a radio producer, and he produced the wonderful documentary Los Reyes de Albuquerque y la Familia Martínez. It's a public radio documentary, an online documentary, and they are here to tell us about a wonderful thing that's coming up at the Lenzic this Saturday, the 17th of April, which is the 10th anniversary of Nuestra Música, and this year it's called Celebración de los Viejitos. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
So what is this event? It happens every year at the Lenzic, and it's quite a show.
Well, basically, this is the, it's hard to believe, the 10th anniversary of a concert of Hispano folk music from Nuevo Mexico that had its origin when Carmela Padilla, a wonderful writer from Santa Fe, called me up about 10 years ago and asked if we could do a benefit performance for the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art. So I immediately contacted mi compañero Enrique Lamadrid, and together we've been producing this concert for all these years, every April at the Lenzic. And also, I'd like to mention that this is something that the Lenzic Theater gets deeply into with regard to providing something for the public, from the public. And it's a big thing for all of us, really.
It's a real inexpensive ticket, too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's $10 unless you're a senior like me, and then it's free.
This is the music of the ground on which we are standing or sitting right now. Northern New Mexico has a centuries-long musical tradition about which you've written this book.
Well, basically it does. A lot of the music that will be heard this weekend, this Saturday night, actually has been, it may have had its origins in Europe. A lot of the dance music was very popular during the 19th century when the wife of Napoleon III loved to have her salons in Paris. And music would come in, songs like La Varsoviana, which means the little girl from Warsaw, and people would dance to that, and it would immediately come across the great water on its way to Mexico City, where the wife of the Emperor Maximilian also loved to have her salons. And then it wended its way right up the Camino Real de Tierra Adentro. Some of the songs we might hear might even come from an earlier period, though. It might come from as early as the time of the Spanish conquest.
How was music used? I mean, there's obviously kind of the emperors and kings who had music in their salon, and then there's the common people who were dancing, and there's religious music, and all these things play into what we have here in New Mexico.
Absolutely. A lot of the vocal music, at least the old vocal music, a few of those songs are traced all the way back to the Iberian Peninsula. There's a musical form known as the romance, which had its origins sometime around 12 or 1300 when the troubadours who were beginning to wander through southern Europe discovered that they could sing in their own language rather than in the Latin that was the prevalent language to be sung in. And they changed the whole character. And these romances actually are narrative ballads that are reminiscent of historic events that actually took place in the life of the gentry. However, as time went on, another narrative ballad came along called the corrido, which is more about the music of la gente, the people.
And their stories.
And their stories. And actually, I read in a book, 35 years ago, that you can trace the entire history of the Mexican Revolution in the corridos that came right out of that period.
Yeah, they're not quite newspaper equivalent, but almost.
Almost, actually. And, for example, Pancho Villa had his very own corridista who traveled with him, and something would happen, and the guy would make up a corrido, and it would go all over the place. There's another wonderful narrative ballad that is very much from the New World, called the Andita, that actually takes characteristics of both Spanish music and Native American music and melds it and makes it come together. And that's both a dance form and a narrative ballad.
And did the development of that corrido style really open up or democratize the form in a way to make everybody feel like they could participate?
You know, I think in a big way it did. I think that basically celebrating the presence of the gentry got to be an old story,
yeah.
especially along around the beginning of the 19th century in Mexico. Right. And we see this incredible array of events that took place that sort of marked the end of a monarchy feeling, sort of an culture, with when Emperor Maximilian was leaned up against the wall and blown away before a firing squad. And then Benito Juarez resumed his role as the elected president of Mexico, and it became a republic once again.
Right.
Mexico has an incredibly difficult history, and one of the things that really gets me about a lot of the narrative ballads is that each of those ballads is a mnemonic device for remembering an event that took place at some point during that history. And then, of course, there's a lot of dance music that came along. All of the waltzes and the what they call the chotes and the polkas and the varsovianas and the valse de los paños and all of these different wonderful musical dance forms. Those are the ones that came right up the Rio Grande and have been celebrated right here in northern New Mexico for a very long time. And actually, a lot of that music, I hope, is going to be performed this Saturday night.
Yeah, well, and we're going to hear a little bit of this today so that people know what we're talking about. You were talking about the influences from Europe and then the influence coming up from Mexico, but there was also quite a bit of isolation. I mean, northern New Mexico didn't have superhighways that connected people culturally. So a lot of the music we're talking about became truly place-based, homegrown music.
Absolutely. There was a highway, actually, the Camino Real de Tierra Adentro, that extended from Mexico City originally to the San Juan Pueblo, and then shortly thereafter stopped, basically, at the Santa Fe Plaza, and then other roads would take off from there. But that was the major highway, and up that highway would come the missionary carretas that contained the goodies that were going to be used by people. But indeed, New Mexico, this part of New Mexico at least, was pretty isolated for between 100 and 150 years. For example, people would recycle their nails because metal was at a premium. And also the language itself retained a lot of its Renaissance characteristics that sort of went away down in Mexico and even over in Spain to a great extent. But
yeah.
I'm a linguist, I'm not, but people like Enrique Lamadrid can talk about that with great clarity, but it's really amazing how isolated these folks were.
And does that still show up in the lyrics of the Spanish lyrics of this folk music?
Yeah.
That kind of antiquated Spanish?
That's a good question. I am not a linguist, but a good song that really reflects stuff that may have happened in northern New Mexico is a song called Cuando de los Cazadores, that is sung by Cipriano Vigil, which talks about the time of the hunters in the early 19th century. And this is a song that really reflects that span of time when northern New Mexico was isolated from Mexico itself. It's an amazing song. It talks about, well, basically, your socks break, so you throw them away. It's how funky it actually was when you had to go out and hunt for your food, and you'd be tracking for days and days, and it was just that sort of, it gave a real flavor, so to speak, of the nature of reality in the late 18th, early 19th centuries, when New Mexico was off by itself.
Why don't we take a listen to that song?
Okay.
El cuando de los cazadores. Destino tan carajo tienen ya los cazadores, no alcanzan para camisa, con más para calzones. Cuando se cargan sus balas de pólvora en sus brazos, cuando vienen de cazar, vienen a dar que es un asco. Cuando estudian pa' contar, diciendo que fue jacalos, se lo mete al corazón, hecho sangre también pelos. Luego se van por los pinos, qué destino tan carajo.
And that was Cipriano Vigil, Cuando de los Cazadores.
You were talking about the isolation of these communities, and one thing that Jack, maybe Roberto Martinez, pointed out when we were working on this documentary that I thought was interesting is because of the isolation of these communities, the musicians played this key role in the community where, you know, the priest couldn't get there to perform a wedding ceremony at a certain time, that essentially the community would wed the couple, and there were certain songs that would, you know, create a procession and a ceremony, and that the musicians and the songs that were developed played this role because of the isolation of these communities.
Absolutely. I had the great, wondrous opportunity to work on a film about 20, 25 years ago with my friend Jack Parsons called Celebración del Matrimonio. And basically, as you say, the wedding march, La Marcha de los Novios, then the wedding waltz, and then, most importantly,
funerals, right?
Well, also the funerals, but there was a certain musical form called La Entrega de los Novios, but there can also be La Entrega de los Difuntos, as you said, Paul, where it's a song of many, many verses made up by the fellow who sings the entregas that he makes up as he goes along. And part of the whole thing is that the purpose within the wedding context is that that's the secular wedding as opposed to the priest performing the sacred wedding. They both need to be there. But without that secular wedding ceremony with the entrega and all of that stuff, the wedding really is not complete in the eyes of the people in the community.
Right. And I think music makes such an emotional connection with people that I'm not trying to say one's more important than the other, but it has a huge importance. You know, it really, and it lives, and it's passed down because it's remembered, as you said. It speaks to the emotional impact that music has and why it brings up so much for us.
Yeah, and even people who aren't particularly musical or musically oriented will have profound sentimental associations with the, for example, Christmas carols of their youth or the songs that were on the radio when they were in the fifth grade or things like that.
Or in my case, every Beatles song ever recorded.
So, exactly. You
know, we all carry that with us, but in this genre, it's, to me, it's really interesting, and it's when you see these songs performed in the modern day venues, like we'll see Saturday, is that you'll see people tear up. You'll see people get these huge grins on their faces. It's visceral what's connected with them. That's just really wonderful to me.
Now you, Paul Ingalls, made a documentary called Los Reyes de Albuquerque y La Familia Martinez. Tell us a little bit about this musical family. It's a very sweet, beautiful, and interesting documentary that you did.
Well, it's interesting because we didn't start trying to document this one family. Genevieve Russell, who's a photographer and visual artist who lives here in Santa Fe, I live in Albuquerque and worked at KUNM, the public radio station down there, for a long time. We had worked together on another project together. We'd worked on a program that spotlighted jazz musicians in New Mexico, where she did the photographs and I did the radio component. And we had success with that, like working together, and decided we would try to create another idea. And we wanted to create a proposal that would allow us to sink into another indigenous type of music for the state of New Mexico. So we talked about doing this, and I think even when we interviewed Jack the first time a couple of years ago about this idea, we were thinking more broadly about investigating lots of practitioners of this type of music, the way Jack has documented it in his books and his CDs. And we were going to use the Los Reyes de Albuquerque, which is the name of the group that Roberto Martinez formed over 40 years ago, as sort of an entryway, because they were planning a tour of the state to celebrate Roberto Martinez's 80th birthday. And so that was the idea, is that we were going to follow them and then connect with these other communities and sort of paint a broad picture of the music. They weren't able to get the funding, frankly, for the tour. And so we had to pause the project in a way and regroup. But in the course of doing the preliminary interviews, it became very clear that the family itself was a story. And also the family itself, actually, the story of the family connected into these streams and strains that we've been talking about. Because Roberto Martinez grew up in Mora, and it had a very, you know, sort of old school childhood. And to watch him move out of that and move to the city and become sort of indoctrinated to urban life, but also committed to preserving the music that he grew up with, and then passing it on to his children, became a very compelling story in itself. And then there are dramatic and tragic twists in this family that, from a storyteller's standpoint, making it even more compelling, which is they had five children. They all got into music. Two of the daughters, three daughters in the family, two of the daughters lost their hearing before, in their young 20s. And Debbie Martinez was a star on the rise in the Hispanic music world, even at that point. And then two of the daughters, Debbie and Maxine, died of cancer in their 40s and 50s, adding another dramatic twist to their story. So, you know, their story became very compelling to tell, and so we focused a little bit more on their family, always connecting back to the traditions that we've been talking about here, and also looking at how they have sort of pulled the traditions into their own interests and their own genres, that particularly the kids got into as they were growing up in the 60s and 70s.
Right. And like all music, folk music both sticks close to its roots and evolves according to what is around it. And of course, there's so many more influences around us than there were when the elder Mr. Martinez was growing up in right. the 30s.
Yeah, they all mix together. And then when the youngsters come along, and I'm in my 50s, they're more my age as a whole. And they tell this story in the documentary that they got into the Beatles and they got into Jimi Hendrix, and those were their musical passions. But their interest in rock and roll didn't have them turning away from their traditions. They stayed very close to the traditions, but they found other ways. They bring that voice and that sensibility in. And in fact, now the latest project for Rob Martinez and Lorenzo has been to produce an album and a stage show of Beatles music done mariachi style.
Oh my goodness!
It's Mariachi Mystery Tour, and I, the last I heard is that they might be taking it to Vegas. So, and it's wonderful. You know, I mean, I said during one of our breaks when we were off the air what a big Beatles fan I am, and that's, you know, appeals to me. But it's so wonderful to hear the flavor and the history coming through, along with their enthusiasm for the music. And of course, all of them have been, and still. Go out and perform the traditional music letter perfect to the way it's always been done.
We're talking to Paul Ingles and Jack Leffler about the upcoming 10th anniversary Celebraciones de los Viejitos. It's the 10th Nuestra Música at the Lenzic this coming Saturday night. Now, when something is passed down through oral tradition, how do you, as an ethnomusicologist, a historian, a scholar of this music, how do you know how it was played in the 17th century or really in the old days?
Well, you don't really know because, well, first of all, the instruments will have changed to a certain extent.
Did the old instruments survive?
Well, the original guitar, I mean, what we think of as the modern guitar, which is used by most modern guitar players today, didn't really come into its own until a couple of hundred years ago. And there were earlier forms of the guitar, earlier forms of the violin. Those are the two instruments that prevail amongst the preceding generation of New Mexico folk musicians. One thing I'd like to mention is that this Saturday evening, Lorenzo Martinez, whom Paul was just mentioning,
he's
an incredible violinista, and his brother Rob is an incredible guitarista. One thing I should mention is that the mariachi music itself does not come from this region. It comes from Mexico, and it's a fairly recent phenomenon, say sometime in the last 70 or 80 years. It started to wind its way northward. And Los Reyes de Albuquerque are really known as being masters of the mariachi. But Roberto Sr. and Lorenzo and Rob are also deeply motivated to make sure that the older traditions of violin and guitar music prevail. I should also mention that Roberto Martinez is, in my opinion, one of the greatest corridistas to have ever come out of New Mexico. He wrote a corrido that I love, is the one about when Reyes Tejerina conducted his raid at the Tierra Maria courthouse back in 1967, I think it was, or six. He wrote another great corrido about the great prison fire in the early 1980s here in Santa Fe, which was the biggest prison riot in American history to that point in time. But basically, to get to your point, you can hear, if you listen to a song like Delgadina, which is an old romance, which may have actually occurred, taken place first in Portugal, you get the feel of a melodic pattern that is not something that is quite as modern as we would imagine ourselves hearing today. Sometimes when you're listening to folk music, this something that's really interesting to me, is you don't hear people counting as you think they ought to be counting. In other words, you may be hearing something that starts out in 3/4 time and then one beat will be dropped in a measure and et cetera, et cetera. That's common to the folk musician who is performing the song. Each time a song is performed by a different musician or set of musicians, it goes through a system of permutations, and the new musician's point of view is applied to that particular song. And I've listened to songs. It was interesting to me, when I started recording this music back in the 1970s, I would hear, say, a chotis or a shadish. And that shadish would be performed a certain way, and then I'd hear another performance of a shadish. And the second part of the original shadish that I'd heard would not be there, but somebody would have put in yet another verse. And so the songs sort of transmigrate within themselves. So you can never really know precisely unless you go back to some of the written music of, say, the 16th, 15th, and 16th centuries. It's interesting to me. This fascinates me. This to me would make a great documentary, Paul.
He's looking at me because he can't do all the documentaries that he has ideas for.
Right.
So he's trying to pass one off here. Listening.
But this is that was a fellow by the name of Pedro de Gante, or Peter of Ghent, who was either a cousin of or an uncle to Charles V, who was a friar. He was a Franciscan friar from Flanders. How's that for alliteration? And
sounds like a limerick.
Yes, really. You could take it a long way. But at any rate, he was part of the group of Franciscans who opened the first school of European music in the New World in 1523. And they taught Native American people how to write liturgical music. And I've actually heard here in Santa Fe, performed by the Desert Chorale and other groups, songs that were composed by Indians who had been trained by Peter of Ghent, or Pedro de Gante, in 1523. That's an incredible story. His effect on the native people of the New World was enormous. Some people regard it as the true Spanish conquest, because instead of being killed in battle, Pedro de Gante lured all of the Indian people into these huge open-air churches through music and dance, just as you were saying, Paul. The music is what captivated people. And subsequently, you can hear in that written music, which is still notated today, you can hear some of the way that those people were thinking musically. And you just imagine that with regard to the folk music here, how raw it can be, and yet it's that very rawness that pulls at your heart and let you know that this music has been flowing through the veins of 20 generations of people in northern New Mexico.
Shall we listen to a song right now that illustrates some of the many things that you're saying? I mean, shall we put on Delgadina?
Yes, that's the very first song in the book, and it is probably the oldest song in the book. And that is Crescencio M. Garcia. I recorded him in the late 1970s in Las Cruces. He's long gone now, but this is his interpretation of La Delgadina.
Delgadina se paseaba y en su sala muy cuadrada con su manto velo de oro que en su pecho iluminaba. Levántate, Delgadina, ponte tu falda de seda, porque nos vamos a misa, a la ciudad de Morelia. Cuando salieron de misa, su papá le platicaba, Delgadina, hija mía, te quiero para dama.
Delgadina, performed by Crescencio Garcia, and it's on the three-disc set called La Música de los Viejitos, Hispano Folk Music of the Rio Grande del Norte, which goes along with this wonderful book, and especially for people who are musicians and who can read music. You've actually transcribed a lot of the music in here. You can play it from, there's charts and in the book.
Yeah, I didn't put in the chord changes because I'd just gotten this computer program, and the only thing I could figure out how to do was put in the key signature, the time signature, the notes on the staves, and that was it.
Well, you have a lot of translations, too. Right?
Yes, and my wife, Catherine, did the original translations, and then they were carefully checked over by Enrique Lamadrid. And so actually, and Enrique made incredible contributions to this book. He's a really great scholar.
Yeah, he also contributed to our documentary as well. So his voice is heard on the radio documentary.
Right. There's just for fun, should we hear just a little piece of one of the tongue twisters?
Yes, a trabalingua. And this is by Solomon Chavez from Alamosa, the late Señor Chavez, who became a great friend.
Estaba una madre godable, piricotable, tarantantable, que tenía tres hijos godijos, piricotizos, tarantantijos. Esta madre godable, piricotable, tarantantable, les dijo a sus hijos godijos, piricotijos, tarantantijos. Ir al monte gondonte, piricontonte, tarantantonte, y tráeme un liebre, godiebre, piricotiebre, tarantantiebre. Fueron los hijos godijos, piricotijos, tarantantijos, al monte godonte, piricontonte, tarantantonte, y le trujeron un liebre, godiebre, piricotiebre, tarantantiebre, a su madre godable, piricotable, tarantantable. La pusieron en la mesa, godesa, piricotesa, tarantantesa, y vino un gato, godazo, piricotazo, tarantantazo, y se comó el liebre, godiebre, piricotiebre, tarantantiebre, que los hijos godijos, piricotijos, tarantantijos, habían traído a su madre godable, piricotable, tarantantable.
So let's talk about the event coming up this Saturday night. It's the 10th Nuestra Música and Música de los Viejitos. I mean, a lot of people are getting older who've been doing this music for a long time, so it's a very special thing because we've already lost a lot of these musicians, and the ones we still have, we're not going to have them forever.
Well, that's true. And this particular Celebración de los Viejitos, actually, when I mentioned it to Cipriano Vigil, who's going to be performing, he suggested that we all walk out on the stage with canes and crutches. The median age is about 65. But at any rate,
the good news is that a lot of these people don't need them. Still, some of them are doing okay.
So
yeah.
Far.
Yeah.
But indeed, there are going to be five different musical acts, but it's going to be preceded by at least a portion of this wonderful film that Paul and Genevieve have put together.
Right.
And it will be that immediately will be followed by Rob and Lorenzo Martinez, and hopefully their father, Roberto Martinez. if he's feeling well enough, because he's one of the people, he's now an octogenarian.
Right.
And whereas I'm only a septuagenarian. And but at any rate, then we will also have, this is a bunch of the favorite groups. Frank McCullough, Y Sus Amigos, who hail from Albuquerque. Frank is actually a native Nuevo Mexicano and is half British Isle and half Hispano, and knows
hence
so
the
many...
Hence the McCullough.
Hence the McCullough. Senor McCullough. And Frank, as a matter of fact, has a brand new CD out called On a Sunday. And then they will be followed by La Familia Vigil, which is Cipriano Vigil and his son and daughter. And then we'll have a brief intermission, and the next moment, musical moment, will be Los Garapatas. This is a group that hails from the eastern side of the Manzano Mountains, and they're known throughout New Mexico and far beyond for the ranchero music. But they're going to be performing the traditional folk music, and Uncle Frank Chavez is going to be, he's a master fiddler. And so, and then the evening will close with El Trio Jalapeño, featuring Tony Abodaca, who is just this wonderful lady. I've got a little story about Antonia. Back in the mid-70s, my wife and I recorded her mom up in the village of Rosiada, New Mexico, and we'd go back time and again and go visit the mom, and one time we got there, the mom wasn't there, but this woman who looked very much like her mom, Antonia Abodaca, was there. And so my wife and I had the opportunity to record Tony and her husband, Macario, who's passed away shortly thereafter. And but we were able to record Max and Tony together, which was really a great thing. And now Tony, who is the recipient of a Governor's Award from New Mexico and many other honors, has performed a lot for the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. She will be there, and she's the final act. And she just carries on like you wouldn't believe. So we have a really wonderful lineup this year. We're all excited. The folks down at the Lensic are really turned on. My friend Steph Smith, who's the tech director down there, has always put together this beautiful stage set, and he's outdone himself yet again this year. So we're going to have a
And this
time.
Is something that the whole community that might not be going to the Lensic for other things turns out and sees, because this is our homegrown music.
It's homegrown music, and for the younger generations, the admission is only $10, which is really something. And then for the older generation, like me, it's free. And people come from all over Nuevo Mexico to attend this. And so we're looking, and it's always a full house.
I'd like to mention, too, that either in anticipation of that, if you're going to the show, or if you go to the show and afterwards, or if you can't go to the show, the website for our documentary has a lot of great music and photographs and the entire version of the film documentary, which will be excerpted there. So if people want to warm up and get a taste, it's losreyesstory.org.
Los Reyes, R-E-Y-E-S.
Story.org. Yeah.
Okay.
This video or this film is just masterfully done. I love this film. And I got to see it when Los Reyes were being honored at the outpost in Albuquerque several months ago, and I was undone by the beauty of it.
We're happy with it. Genevieve is really a great visual artist, and so I think people will have a chance to see it. You know, whether or not you go to the show, check it out, because the full-length version is there, as well as the full-length audio documentary. You can follow it.
And it gives you such a sense of New Mexico a couple of generations ago, how people lived, what their daily life was like, because the father tells the story of his childhood.
Right. You know, gathering wood in the mountains and all those stories. We slipped a few of those in.
Yeah. The event is Nuestra Música, the 10th anniversary celebración de los viejitos. Jack Leffler is an ethnomusicologist, oral historian, oral spelled A-U-R-A-L, as in auditory. And his book is La Música, one of his books is La Música de los Viejitos, Hispano Folk Music of the Rio Grande del Norte, with a wonderful 3-CD set that you can buy separately. And Paul Ingalls is a radio producer, and the documentary Los Reyes de Albuquerque y la Familia Martínez can be found at
losreyesstory.org.
Losreyesstory.org. And we will see you all at the Lensic this Saturday night.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And we're going to go out with a little more music. Shall we play a corrido?
Why don't we listen to the Corrido de Rio Riba that was written by Roberto Martinez?
Perfect. I'd like now to welcome poet Carl Gartung. His new book is called Now That Memory Has Become So Important, and he will be speaking today at Garcia Street Books here in Santa Fe at a book launch and celebration at 5 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So let's talk for a moment about the title, Now That Memory Has Become So Important. This is related to the fact that the place where you were born and raised no longer has anybody from your family, you, or any living relatives? Is that what it's about?
It doesn't have any immediate family. I have cousins that live there. My parents both grew up there, and they're both buried there, but they're all gone. The title is meant somewhat ironically, you know. It's meant entirely seriously, but at the same time, memory, you know, is doubtful as to its importance. So it's meant doubly.
Right, right. Tell us about this place in Kansas where you're from.
Well, I grew up in Liberal, Kansas, which I like to say is a place in a contradiction. It was kind of a natural gas boom town during the 50s, and before that, you remember the Dust Bowl photograph of the guy walking across the yard through a sand drift with his two kids? Well, that's where I grew up, more or less. My family were all wheat farmers and moved around looking for natural gas to be on top of and stuff. All the kind of foolish things that people do.
How does Kansas, do you think, play into your poetry?
I can't very well escape it. The book is laid out kind of like a field, you know, takes a photograph actually from Wisconsin, but then works it like a field, you know, between sections. So I really can't get away from the agriculture, you know, wheat.
You use a device which I've never seen before, which is you have a lot of poems that are in two columns that kind of meet in the middle. Are you trying to get the readers to read them both down and across?
Yeah, it really doesn't. I like for people to enter a poem like from any direction that strikes their eye, and then I like for them to try to puzzle through it. So in those what I call split poems, they work out. They're kind of a dialogue in nature, and also something like film credits, which are also dialogues. You know, where you have a person and then the person they're playing, and there's a what happens in between them is what drives the thing. And so I like that. I like the idea that the meaning of the poem comes down that blank spot in the middle instead of through the words directly.
Yeah, it was interesting because what I found was that for a lot of them, if you read them down in two columns, you can get a sense of continuity, but you don't get the whole poem.
No. And there's a continuity that goes both ways. A lot of times I'm doing syllabic structures. I count syllables and I'm trying to pay attention to the sound of it all the time. And then it's when I was a kid, I liked to read books straight across instead of reading. I would read right across the gutter of the book and see if I could keep both pages in my head at the same time.
Oh my goodness!
And well, it was just a it was a game.
Yeah.
But then I liked the way it works in poetry, you know, because it makes the meaning more ambiguous but deeper in some ways.
It makes it probably a little complicated if you're reading aloud.
I usually read them only one way, although a shorter one I might read two or three different ways to give an idea of the possibilities of it.
Would you like to read one or two of your poems right now?
Sure. I could read one of those. It's kind of the first poems, the poetic introduction to the book. The other thing I do is I look up words in dictionaries. If I have an idea I'm working on and want to understand better, I often use language that I find in OED or in Webster's or whatever, or in an encyclopedia. And so in this case, I was curious. I thought I would find garden in the definition of serenity, and I didn't. So anyway, words fail me. I was looking for a garden in serenity, a landscape of words, how we achieve moments, attention. Any way you remain place open, this is specific, both place and time, words, these landscapes, places specific to light, time, measured moments accumulated, we see. Words measure it, measure in the sense of music, the poem. We seek entry through words, most intimate, phallus, insight, fails us, accumulation of measures made of word, moment, undirected, that this garden, what would, can be entered from many directions, be revealed in each walk here, unimagined by gardener.
We're talking to Carl Gartung, and he's reading from his book, Now That Memory Has Become So Important. For people who are reading poems like yours, I think you have to kind of give up a certain kind of understanding, a certain kind of linear understanding of what they mean, mm-hmm. and just kind of give yourself to it and see what happens. And if you read it repeatedly, different things happen.
Right, each time. I don't only write that way, but the great Wisconsin poet Laureen Niedeker talked about how all poems, if they were good, are circular in nature, and I really believe that.
What does that mean?
Circular in the sense that thought doubles back on itself or grows, you know, circularly and shoots things off. So everything relates to everything, she said. And I like to write poems that work that way.
You have some very short poems, too, in the book.
Right. I've got a baseball poem.
Let's hear it.
A true experience. Ready? Be alive. You'll want to know what raised that knot between your eyes and how it got there.
Now that's a baseball poem.
Yeah, yeah.
Would we have known that if you hadn't told us?
I don't know. You might have if you'd ever put your glove up to catch a ball and had the ball hit you in the forehead.
Ah, that knot.
That knot. But it could be another knot, too.
Right. I thought it was a knot of consternation when I read it.
Yeah, it could be that, too. We had a third baseman in Milwaukee named Randy Reddy, who was supposed to be the next big player, you know, and would regularly throw the ball into the stands and did some kind of comical things in the field.
Right.
So I had a satirical moment.
You have some work in this book about the loss of a newborn child.
Yes, correct.
Do you want to read from that?
Yeah, I could read. There's a straightforward poem of the beginning of the pregnancy. Anne became pregnant, and I thought, well, I'll write that, you know. And then when things didn't work out, I thought I might write out of it, you know, and which, of course, didn't really work. But at any rate, some of the poetry I like. Fantastic. It was fantastic. Pregnant, her description. A fish nibbling at bait, the barest tug on the line. And this is one of the first poems that I wrote using the dictionary. I wanted to get a definition of I think it works pretty well. Not a single word in here was a word that I actually sat down and wrote without copying, you know what I mean? But a picture which does still not show movement. Born, brought to life to hush, he was still born. Silence, put to rest continuously. Pacify, more, brought to life, a son was born in a greater degree, still water in a pond. A born singer, silent by actual birth, or as if still, I intend to go, not noisy, notwithstanding is a still small voice by nature, nevertheless, except in the sense of receiving, as if by birth, birth, placid, boisterous, clamorous, the winds were still, her son was born. Now that was written the same way that the split poems are written, but it's not laid out that way,
right?
Because I settled kind of on an order, you know. And it turns out that I must have been picking up on a poem I'd read a long time ago from an anonymous poem from way back when, a kind of an elegy. But somebody pointed that out to me, Stephanie Strickland. So,
yeah, we've got time for one or two more poems.
Okay. Well, this is another spring poem. What is that green shadow on the hill? Must be the new blades of spring. Despite our humbug, free of it, the birds return. It is the cardinal song. And another spring poem. Small is not petty. Little distances the woods are. We say the forest is alive with them. One to another, the small songs. And then here's one kind of on the state of poetry today, or the state of poets today. I know poets hired to write computer manuals, precisely, so people can understand and make use of them.
So, very interesting.
Well,
you
know.
Is that true?
Yeah, actually it is true. Quite a famous poet, Ron Silman, who runs a blog called Silman's Blog that everybody refers to, and who's a language poet.
And who writes computer manuals.
Yeah.
So most poets have a day job.
Right.
What about you?
I drive a truck. Well, I have two day jobs. We my wife and I run a bookstore called Wool and Pattern Book Center in Milwaukee over 30 years now. And we've sponsored about 1,000 readings over that time.
So one of the holdout independent bookstores,
right,
of which we have several here in Santa Fe as well.
Right, and I'm really happy to be reading at an independent bookstore. It feels like home, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're a little bit of a specialty store. We have about 30,000 titles of poetry, and we have an art gallery and a music series and then a poetry reading and workshops. And we do a lot of work with neighborhood kids, art and poetry. So we've been fortunate to be able to do that. And then I have my other day job is I drive a truck for UPS, either a straight truck or a tractor trailer. And I'm a kind of a union steward there. That's how I keep going.
Carl Gartung's new book of poetry is called Now That Memory Has Become So Important. And once again, he will be speaking today at 5 o'clock at Garcia Street Books here in Santa Fe. You can find them on the web at garciastreetbooks.com. Thanks for being with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features an interview with jazz vocalist Julia Dollison discussing her project of the music of Maria Schneider. Happy Tax Day. We will see you tomorrow. We'll be talking about animals, and Robert Knott will be with us speaking of the arts.